Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a fascinating conversation with Terry Bass, who's the author of a new book, The Greatest of Ease, A Circus Story. And this one is not made up.
No, it's not made up. I told the kids today, well, I used to be a trapeze, and they're like, I was. They're like, prove it. Okay.
That is hilarious. Literally, that's something you couldn't fake.
No. Yeah. And it's funny because for years after I quit the circus, it was just an antidote at parties, you know?
Oh, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And I always would just drop it in. Oh, when I was with the circus, and like everybody would stop talking. And it was finally like I was running the writer's conference and I was telling everybody, you got to write your story. And then I'm like, you know, I got one that hardly anybody else ever did. Mm-hmm. So I kind of need to write it.
That's so funny. And most people know you as executive director of Central Coast
Writers Conference.
Writers Conference.
Yeah. And then I was a food critic for 21 years here. Mm. And then I had my TV show, Taste Buds. So
I remember that.
Yeah, great. And then I did all the events for Morro Bay and Pismo. But when the pandemic hit, I lost all my jobs. You know, I kept saying, well, if everything would just go away, I'd write this book. So on March 12, 2020, guess what I started doing? Writing this book.
Since you were homebound.
Yeah. And I go, okay, we're going to unroll my past and take that box out and unpack it.
How easy did it come to you, that process of telling the story?
Well, you know, it's like I know the little anecdotes. What I didn't realize was that it would be me returning to my 20-something self, who was a complete and utter idiot. And unpacking that was like excruciatingly embarrassing and shameful. And so at first I wrote it in first person, and then I just stopped.
Really?
And then somebody suggested, just change it to a character. Just write a third person. I'm like, oh, that's genius. So then I named her Gail.
Uh-huh.
And then it was easier to write.
Really? That's interesting.
So it was like, I'm just telling a story about this girl.
A little safer with that distance.
It was. Well, yeah, because there's a love story with my ex-husband, and there's nothing worse than going back there. It's like, ugh. Then when it was all said and done, they're like, no, this is stronger in first person. So then I had to change all the third person to first person. So I did it the hard way.
So in the end, first person.
It's first person, but her name is Gail.
It's all true.
It's all true, yeah. So it's called a Romana Clay, which most people don't know about, but like To Kill a Mockingbird, On the Road with Jack Kerouac, a couple other big books that we know are Romana Clays. So they're basically, everything in them is true, but they changed the timeline and kind of the plot sequence to drive the narrative.
Kind of historical fiction.
Exactly. That's what I call it, historical fiction, because it's about the 80s. So that was the other thing to unpack, was I had to keep reminding the reader we were in the 80s. There was no centralized bank. I didn't have credit cards. There was no cell phones. There was no email. And in the circus, you don't have a defined path. When you start, you know you're going to be in the big cities like Portland and San Francisco and Denver, but it just stops in between, finds a town with a field, and we do it there. So
it's real random in some respects.
So random. Like, I got my mail twice a year, at the beginning of the season, at the end of the season.
You couldn't go incommunicado anymore.
No. Yeah. I mean, I had to, you know, find 14 quarters in order to call my mother to say hi, and then it would say, sorry, you're out, money. So there's a lot of times that people are saying, well, why didn't you just leave? Well, it wasn't like that. You just couldn't leave. I mean, I guess I could have hopped on board with a trucker, but I wasn't going to do that.
You're pretty trapped.
Very trapped.
Yeah.
And that was another thing. My memory serves all the fun anecdotes of it, but I forgot how trapped I was for 5 years. And it was like literally like PTSD going back, going... Mm-hmm.
But when you're in the midst of it, you were living it.
It was
so
perfect.
Yeah.
I was 20. I was so dumb. I wanted to travel. I had no money. So this was perfect. I mean, I've been in every single major city and most of the small ones in Canada, Mexico, and the United States.
Was it a major circus with like Ringling Brothers?
Or? Yeah, we did two seasons with Ringling Brothers. So the way that circus works is there's like circus owners who back in the 80s partnered with other circuses.
Mm-hmm. So like subcontracting?
Yes. It was the first time it had happened. So we were with the Shrine Circus. Mm-hmm. And so the Shriners had decided to make that children's hospital, but they didn't know how to fund it. So they partnered with these circus owners, and so they would go into their town, pick the big arenas, because all the big towns had made those arenas.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the Shriners would, like, give them all the tickets and work it, and then get their daughters and stuff to sell
would
the popcorn.
Would they show
and stuff.
Up with their little cars?
And, yes. Yeah. I have a good story in there about an elephant trying to eat a Shriner. Yeah. They would have their little cars and always the fezes and not well-behaved ever, ever.
That's funny. Let's reel back way far in Terry's life. Pre-circus, pre-trapeze artist. How did it start happening for you?
So my dad was a Shriner. And so from 13 years old, I had to go to the circus every year and sell popcorn and cotton candy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, because I'm so shy, I met a lot of the performers. And there was one that just kept coming back every year. His family stayed on that same circuit. His name was Raphael. In the book, he's Ramon. And so we became friends.
What did he do?
He was a balancer, a juggler, a clown. He did a little bit of everything, but his was always with a humorous, quite the scoundrel. I just loved him. When I was 20... I was having some tough times, and the circus came to town. I went there. Raphael was there, and he said, "Hey, I have these new guys who are on with us. You love them. Let's go out." So we went out to dinner that night, and you know, everybody's like, "Well, what was it?" I'm like, "Oh, it was kind of the red tights." I mean, I was running from something.
Mm-hmm.
I was stupid in 20 and doing really stupid things. I had a boyfriend that like forged a check at my work, and all sorts of really dumb things were happening to me. This seemed like a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't take an account that we were going to live in trailers, because back then people didn't live in travel trailers. Only super rich people had them on the weekends. Nobody lived in them full-time. And it wasn't him in his trailer. It was his mother, his father, his little brother, and him. So it's a 26-foot trailer, and there's already four humans living in there full-time.
But trailers were really intrinsic to the circus workers.
Yeah.
It was like a caravan.
Yeah, we
guys.
Were the first ones to really do it, because while we were going cross-country, there's, I think it was in Kansas, a trailer manufacturer that made them just for us.
Wow.
And used our intel to fix them, because we were the only people that were in them all the time.
Right, right. So you
like,
knew what...
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Well, this rattles all the time. And so they made new ones for us every year.
That's really cool.
Yeah, because we were like, okay, this Barbie stove is not going to work. This Barbie refrigerator is not going to work. We need a full-size fridge. And now they all have it.
Back in the day, 40s and 50s, the circus train...
Right.
Was legendary.
Right.
Did that still exist when you started?
It did. Ringling was still doing the trains, but the animals and some of the workers lived on the trains. The rest of us just followed the train. You know, that's why they started doing
it. So the elephants almost had to have a train, right?
Yeah. Well, and the only reason the elephants became in the circus is because they had no way to set those tents. There was no machinery back then.
Wow.
So they were workers. So the elephants would pull and set the tents. They had to have 10 elephants to be on each side of it.
Wow.
And they'd set the tents. So they'd be first off the train, and they'd parade through town, and then they'd put the tent up.
Elephants, were they compliant?
Oh, yeah. They love it.
Uh-huh.
So
they took their job seriously.
You know, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because all the propaganda for circus animals until now is all
the abuse.
Just bullshit.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
Baloney. Those animals loved their jobs. Mm-hmm. Most of them were born in the circus because their parents were there. I mean, by the time I got there, they were like third generation elephants. They love their job. And now, since PETA threw them all out of the circus, they're all in refugees areas.
Mm-hmm. I went to an elephant refuge in Tennessee.
Yep, her name's Patty.
Yeah, they have 26 retired elephants, and you can't go visit them.
Right.
You can go to the interpretive center, but their rule is that, no, these elephants get to live a peaceful life.
But the trainers will tell you that they still have to make them perform every day, otherwise the elephants get upset.
Oh, really?
So they don't do it for people, but they when they get up in the morning, they're like, okay, everybody up, and they do their little thing because they're performers at heart. That'd be like taking the stage away from you and me. It's like, no.
They didn't tell me that at the elephant
section. Of course
not.
They don't tell you that because everybody go, I want to see the elephants just perform randomly. But yeah.
That's really a trap.
Yeah, because they're used to it. Now, the cats, the tigers and the lions are just tigers and lions. They're just big house cats. They have no interest in doing anything for
anybody.
They're
just hanging out.
Yeah.
As you might recall, in the 70s, I worked on fish boats out of Kodiak.
Right.
And a deckhand was from the Ringling Brothers Circus.
Ah.
And he had a trapeze act that he did. And he set up a trapeze in his room. It was a World War II converted General Stores barge. So
right.
His ceiling was like 20 feet tall.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And he had me try it. And it is so humbling, man.
For my husband's 50th birthday, he wanted to try it because he'd heard you talk about it forever. So there's a couple trapeze schools, and this one is in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went up there, and I knew the troupe because it's a small world. And they were so excited to have a real trapeze artist there. So my husband went up, and he flew, and they came back down, and then he flew, and then he came back down. And then he was like, I can't feel my arms. We used to have to do this 10 times a day. Get up there. And then after he was done, because he knew more than most, so he was like, I want to go to the catcher. I want to do this. And they're like, okay. As we're walking back to the BART, he's like, I'm not sore at all. The next morning, we'll go from his chin to his toes. It hurt. Because it uses muscles that you never had. Pilates was invented by a trapeze artist that was stuck in a Nazi camp during World War II.
Wow.
So he wanted to keep himself in shape because there's very specific muscles you use for the trapeze. And so that's what it is. And so now all Pilates instructors, when some of their students get high ranking, they say, go try the trapeze. And so that day in London, there was like 5 Pilates girls in there going, yeah, I'm the strongest one. And they're like, oh my goodness. You have to be able to sit in midair. So you've got the bar, but you have to be able to pull your legs up and sit. So it's all just in your core. It's not in your arms hardly at all. It's just in the core. And you have to hold that position because if not, your back hits the platform.
And the balance is just so humbling, maintaining that.
I had never been a gymnast. I was nothing but a cowgirl. So I had none of these muscles. And so it took 6 months on the ground to train my muscles to be able to do all that and my body to know where I was in midair because that doesn't come naturally. Pilots have to learn it. Trapeze artists, if they're born in the family, they're born with it. My kids were born with it. My grandkids were born with it. Skipped me. It was their OG dad.
Back up a moment. So you joined the circus.
I did.
You didn't start in the trapeze department.
Oh, no. No, the very first day they made me ride an elephant. They put this ridiculous bikini on me and this 6-foot hat on me and put me on the back of an elephant.
And it worked.
They kind of just put me on the elephant and shoved me out the curtain. So my only choice was to fall, and I wasn't doing that. So
did you steer the elephant or kind of
no.
They knew what to do.
They don't need us little humans. I mean, the chains that you see them on are only a suggestion. They can snap them like they want. The elephants can never be alone. First of all, they eat every 4 hours, but they also are so smart. You know, they're there if you're there. But we went to Chinese dinner one night and up in a small town in Canada. And when we came back, the elephants were still in their chains, right? They like put themselves back in there. But they had eaten every tree and every fence just like a hurricane had come through.
Wow.
They'd picked it up and just thrown things down because they were mad we were gone. So, yeah.
And I've been in Africa, and they can eat a tree.
Yep.
Yeah, one elephant can strip
it. Just pull it up.
Yeah. Okay, so you're in the circus. They start you on the elephant. What happened? How did...
All the circuses back then, whenever they went to towns, we had what was called a lead clown. They would go out, and they would find pretty girls and bring them in and dress them up in costumes. Because circuses are usually made up of 5 or 6 families who do each 4 or 5 acts. On the bigger towns, they want more people, and so they would just get pretty girls to walk around and prance around. And so then I did that with the elephants forever, and then I was also a magician's assistant throwing him stuff. Oh, and I helped the juggler throwing him stuff.
And you just alluded to something. In my experience, families and multi-generational families, like the deckhand in Alaska, he was like third generation.
Yeah. The family that I flew with was seventh generation.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I was one of the first people that wasn't family that got into the circus, not being, because prop guys came and went a lot. Mm-hmm. But I was the first like actual flyer that had been, well, not welcomed in by any stretch of the imagination, but had infiltrated the circus and became part of it. Like on our first tour, nobody liked me.
Wow. Because you were an outsider?
I was a towner. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't trust us. We don't trust them. So, yeah, and so it took
about, but you put up with it.
Again, 20 yeah. and stupid. I should have just gone home, but nope, I didn't. In fact, there's so many times that I did go back home, mm-hmm. and then I would just hightail it back to the circus again.
Was there something addictive about it?
Yeah, totally, yeah. totally. Yeah. You know, you perform 3 shows a day.
So it's kind of that adrenaline. And
yeah, and it was the first time I had lived an athlete's life because we couldn't eat anything bad. We had to, because we flew 3 times a day for the shows, and then we practiced every night because if we missed a trick, we got docked pay.
Oh, wow.
And the better tricks you can put in there, the more money you make. So we practice every night to keep our tricks not only safe, but get more.
And so throughout your career with the circus, you stayed a trapeze artist the whole time?
Well, I flew till I was 6 months pregnant with my son.
Oh, wow.
I actually hit the net and felt his little body move inside of mine. I'm like, oh, okay, this is... Well, I had doctors say, your body's conditioned to do this. You can do it until you're not comfortable. And so that's...
So you switched back to being a clown?
I switched back to being a magician's assistant. There's a great picture of me with my little belly, and I'm throwing rings at him. But then I started flying 2 months after he was born.
Wow.
And I was so sure that it was like my body wasn't going to... It was like it knew what it was doing.
Mm-hmm. So how did your career end?
Divorce. No. We had stopped being on the road because I had yet another baby. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is not what I signed up for my children to be. I mean, clearly they're going to be circus children all their lives, but I can't... This constant traveling.
So you waited till they got out of high school to sell them to the circus?
They were like 2. Circus Reno had just opened. Circus Reno and Circus Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. So then it was like the best of both worlds. We could still be trapeze artists, but stay in one spot.
Have a house.
Yes. What a concept. I had concrete around me instead of wheels. And he was like the best flyer in the world. He had won Monaco a couple times. He was a big deal.
Wow.
And then he was like, I want to be a hairdresser of all things. So he went to hair school, and then we were working at Circus Nights.
What a trip.
Yeah.
So post-circus, what happened to Terry?
I went on to be a bartender. When we stopped with the flying with the circus, I became a bartender because I could work nights, and he was going to school during the day. And then when we split, I got into radio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was...
So you had your own show?
No. I was a sales girl. I wore the suit and the nylons and the whole thing.
So you're being a grown-up for your first time.
I was, and it was funny. And back then, I never told anybody I came from the circus. Mm-hmm. I never mentioned it, because to me, it was like something shameful happened to me. And then once I married my current husband, he's like, tell people. And I'm like, okay. But and then, you know, I kind of stayed in marketing and events. They all started with the radio station because it was a rock and roll station. So I had to do jet ski races and beer things and Budweiser girls and all that stuff. So I just kind of got a flair for marketing and events, and that's where I stayed.
And so how did writing and screenwriting start for Terry?
You know, it was when we moved here. Gary and I met in Reno and were married there, but neither one of us wanted to stay there. And so when the circus husband left to go back to the circus, we're like, because, you know, our divorce decree said we couldn't leave town. But when he went to Argentina, we're like, we're out of here. So we got in the car and we drove to Pismo Beach. I'd never been here before.
Wow.
Walking on the beach, and I'm just like, this is it. He's like, you're right. And we sold 2 businesses and a house in less than a month and moved to Pismo Beach. He had to stay behind for one of the businesses. So it was like 6 weeks I was here by myself. And I'm like, what am I going to do with myself? I don't know anybody. And so I saw that there was a writing course at Cal Poly. And so I took it. I went in and Her name was Ingrid Reddy. Everybody knows
her.
Yeah, everybody knows her. The first thing she did was she made us write a story about something that happened that day. And I was talking about how I got there an hour early and I was circling the Cal Poly campus and then I got nervous and then I left and I got back and then I was late because I couldn't find parking. So I just parked in a handicap. And I'm just, you know, writing like it's no big deal. And then after everybody's done, Ingrid says, all right, who wants to read theirs? And like half of the class, I swear, went running for the hills. And I'm like, I will. So I read it. And Ingrid said the most magic words to me I've ever heard. She said, you should go on from there.
Wow.
And then go move your car. And so I stayed with Ingrid. I took all her classes. And then she finally took me and three other girls into like a monthly class in her living room, just encouraging us to write. And so I wrote the first screenplay, not knowing format. I didn't have software. I didn't know anything about anything. I just had this story inside me, and Ingrid kept saying, you should go on from there.
So you had no fear because you didn't know any better.
Exactly. Dummy curve. Yeah. Absolute dummy curve. And then when it was finished, I had planned on doing it myself because my husband had gotten me one of these classes where you go down to Hollywood and they teach you how to make a movie. It's like a 3-day class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had listened to his instruction and wrote it from do it to film it in my house. So I took the script down to my cousin who had just started this new partnership in LA, and I left her with the script and just, you know, what do you think? Because she'd done a couple movies at that point. She was a producer. Then like 3 weeks later, she called and she says, we want to buy the movie.
Wow.
And it was Morgan Freeman and her. So
that's pretty cool.
Total dummy curve.
So it got made into a movie?
No.
Yeah.
So it was called Hookah.
And that's called a movie script being optioned.
Right. It was optioned. It was called Hookah. It was about the art of storytelling. We had our own kids, and then we fostered and adopted a bunch of kids. So we raised our kids with no TV, much to their dismay.
Yeah, really.
Everybody had to tell stories at night. That was the admission to have dinner, to spend the night or whatever. And so all the storytelling took place around a Middle Eastern peace pipe, which is called a hookah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we got the teenagers engaged, because they thought they were so cool, but it was fruit pulp. They were smoking fruit pulp, but it looks like a big bong, right?
We're in
California. So Revelations optioned the script. It was September 1st, 2001.
Oh, wow.
And September 11th, the towers fell, and everything Middle Eastern went out of...
Yeah, really.
Out of favor. Disney had bought it, and they had changed it to... This is so funny, that it was in the future... And the kids didn't go to school. They sat in little cubicles and just looked at their computers and did one-on-one instruction with the computer. Exactly what came to pass
right.
in COVID. The screenwriter had been helping me during that part of it. He goes, we predicted the future. I'm like, oh, no. You know, the refrigerator knew when you were out of eggs. I mean, we thought we were so high-reaching. But then that just kind of floundered. Oh, the guy who optioned it left Disney, and then it went to Fox. So there's like 9 alliterations of this because they love the aspect of the storytelling, but they just couldn't get it. After 10 years of optioning, I just took it back. Now I look at it and it's just so bad. It's
Who knew?
Who knew? Yeah. Well, I mean, it might have been good for then, but ugh. But this was even before any kind of social media. So now it's even more prevalent. Somebody reached out to me and said, will you spruce that up? I'm like, absolutely not. I'll give you another one, but I'm not touching that turd. Nah.
That's funny. Back to the book. It's out now.
It is.
Yeah. So have you heard feedback?
Yeah, I have. Mostly good. Mm-hmm. I did a book club Zoom with some English teachers at 8:30 in the morning last week because they're from all over the world, and so 8:30 was like the pretty much barbecued me. It was
really?
Kind of awesome.
Wow. What was the criticism?
Okay, so originally I felt that I really needed to explain to the audience why I ran away and joined the circus.
Mm-hmm.
Although sitting here at 61 years old, I still can't tell you why I really ran away and joined the circus. I had a full ride to Mills College. I had 4 years completely paid for.
Wow.
And I gave up that to go to the circus. They couldn't get past that. They couldn't believe that anybody would ever do that. And I was like, the first draft, I had 75 pages in the beginning that explained pretty much me and
the setup.
So my developmental editor, who's Zoe Quinton, who's had like 18 books on New York Times bestseller,
wow.
she said, "Nap, cut the first 75 pages."
Oh, interesting.
I'm like, but how will they know? She's like, they don't need to know. This isn't about you so much as about the journey. And so I was like, well, my editor said the English teachers were having none of that.
So have you done any book talk presentations?
I have. My very first one I did at the Spoon Trade in Grover Beach. So we made it like a circus event. I found 4 girl flyers and I have a portable trapeze.
So you found real flyers?
I found real flyers. So they fly while I'm talking about it.
Oh, wow.
It's awesome. So we put it in the front patio area of the Spoon Trade. And then Jacob, the chef, made all sorts of circus food. And then it was like one set price, and it was wine and food, and included a signed book. It was only $55. So it sold out like immediately.
That's so cool. Did you have any clowns show up?
No, we did. My husband wanted me to get a tiger because I talk a lot about tigers. And we found a place that will rent one for $500.
Wow.
And I'm like, no, I don't want a tiger in a restaurant.
So do you have any more things like that on the...
Yeah, I have some planned for, I think it's in August, in a winery up in Paso Robles. Mm-hmm. And then I have another one for San Luis Obispo restaurant. So I'm finding that those things work better than the traditional book signings. I'm also doing author talks at all the libraries. Mm-hmm. I've done Cayucas, Cambria, Oceano, Napomo, Aurora Grande, a lot of them.
Do you sell the books directly too?
Yeah.
So to learn more about Terry's world, so, do you have a go-to
Yeah,
place?
It's terrybayas.com.
So that's really complicated.
TerriBayas.com.
On that site, there's a place to click.
Yeah, and the book has its own website, because in that website, it has all of my schedule and pictures of the circus. And
the book is called The Greatest of Ease.
The Greatest of Ease, from that song.
A Circus Story.
Yeah.
With Terry Bayas. I love it. Terry, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Tom.
You just light up my day every time.
I know. We kind of get along really well.
Yeah. Because we both make stuff up.
Exactly.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been visiting with author and trapeze artist Terry Bayas. We'll see you under the big top.
There we go.
Yeah.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The Foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer on KCBX Radio. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station. ¶¶